today. Travelling to Greece alone in a pandemic for IVF treatment. In March, as country after country was going into lockdown, music journalist and broadcaster Laura Barton got on a plane in London and flew to Heraklion in Crete.
I arrived late on a Saturday. It's a religious place and also had just gone into pandemic lockdown, so not very much was open. But I was able to sort of hear some reassuring sounds like church bells and local cats and all that kind of stuff. And it was a sunny Sunday and that was quite soothing.
Laura wasn't embarking on a badly timed holiday. She had come to Crete because after years of trying for a baby, she wanted to pursue IVF alone. And she was advised that Greece was a place where she could get good treatment more affordably than at home. As the COVID-19 pandemic spread, IVF clinics across the UK were closing, meaning tens of thousands of people lost hope of starting treatment. Meanwhile, Laura on the flight to Crete was carrying her own hope that this time, this treatment would bring a baby.
There are a few songs that really encapsulate that time. There was a King Princess song called Your Pussy Is God. Your pussy is God and I love it. Gonna kiss me real hard, make me want it. Which you can probably interpret any way you wish. There's a John Hiatt song called Have a Little Faith in Me. Have a little faith in me. Which, I mean, I guess all together is about femininity and fertility and hope and faith. So it was me sort of listening to that playlist in particular and wandering around warm and spring-like Heraklion and it's everything smelt of orange blossom. And it was a beautiful time. And particularly when I had the embryo transfer, to feel that you're wandering around like that, sort of carrying something precious, is quite a powerful feeling, I guess.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, one woman's solo IVF journey. What did it feel like to make that journey?
I travel a lot for work and I've never seen Heathrow so sombre, so quiet. I flew the day after 9/11 and it was a bit like that in sort of atmosphere. And then everyone on the plane pretty much, they were Greek and returning to Greece.
Very strange. Did you have a sense that you were escaping the chaos or flying into it?
To be honest with you, I probably thought it might be worse in Greece because it was just at the point where we were seeing these horrific images from Italy and moving into Spain. So I imagined that the austerity that Greece had been through in recent years might mean that the health system couldn't handle anything.
You managed to get to Crete despite the world going into lockdown around you, and you were ready to begin the IVF process. But one very important piece of this puzzle was missing, and it was making its way to you by boat.
Yes, so when you do solo IVF, you can obviously choose to use a donor that you know, or you can use donor sperm. And I had chosen the latter, but it has to be couriered across by DHL. So it had to go all across mainland Europe as Europe was shutting down. It got to Athens, and I was breathing a massive sigh of relief. And then it was Greek Independence Day, so it just sat in the depot for ages. By that stage, they'd grounded all the flights to Crete, so it had to come by boat. And on the morning that I was having my egg retrieval, which obviously you need the sperm to be there pretty much on at the same time, it still hadn't arrived. And I was sort of calling the couriers, trying to work out how quickly they could get to me. And, you know, if they were going to courier things around Heraklion, could they please make it the priority to get my parcel? I didn't specify what it was. I always wanted to have children. Ever since I was a child, I imagined I would have a really large family.
Had you imagined how it would happen? I mean, I've never been pregnant, but, you know, when I think about it, I sort of imagine that it will happen in, you know, ideally this lovely, easy way with someone that I'm in a great relationship with. How would you envisaged it happening to you?
I guess there was a point in my late 20s where I might have thought I'd start having children very young because I was married at that point. That ended in my early 30s. I think in terms of how we think our life is going to be, when I left my marriage, I realised that a lot of those scripts that we carry were not written by us anyway, you know. So I didn't mind that my life wasn't going to look perhaps how I might have imagined when I was, you know, 18. But I guess I'm at the point now where I have to rethink it all again with greater sadness.
You've been pregnant before, but tragically you've lost those pregnancies. What does that feel like?
The first time it happens, it's completely bewildering because pregnancy is this all-engulfing, really electric feeling. I've described it before when I've written about it as like every atom singing, and it does feel like that. And then suddenly you're aware that something has stopped. Well, that's been for several of my pregnancies. Others have been going into a checkup and finding out that there was a time I was expecting identical twins and they had no heartbeat. There are so many ways, different ways to lose a child. I suppose that's one thing that you learn. But you know that grief is going to come. And it's such a strange grief because sometimes people that you know don't know you're pregnant, or it seems silly to feel that intense grief for someone that didn't ever really exist. Your body still feels pregnant for such a long time. And a lot of that time will also be eaten up with blaming yourself and thinking about things you did or didn't do, you know.
I was reading before speaking to Laura that one in four women have experienced miscarriage in the UK, and this is something that happens to so many people, but it really just isn't spoken about. Why do you think that is?
One of the things that I find very, very difficult is the 3-month rule where you don't tell people that you're pregnant. And I do understand reasons for that, but it seems so antiquated because if you were able to say really early on that you were pregnant, and also those 3 months are when you feel that you're most foul, you could explain why you're behaving oddly or, you know, whatever. But also it would give people chance to talk about pregnancy loss a lot more easily. And I think there's a degree of shame around it probably too. You know, no matter how sort of modern and independent or whatever we see ourselves, we feel as if we fail as a woman when we fail to be successfully pregnant.
Yeah, it is a very odd thing. And as you say, I think everybody knows somebody who's been through it. Were you able to talk about your miscarriages with your friends and family?
Yes, I was. And I have found sort of talking to a therapist really, really helpful about it, though. It's hard, I think, particularly when you are losing babies at around the same time that your friends are having babies. And sometimes people maybe don't want to speak to you because you might be, I don't know, it feels as if you're bad luck, or you might tarnish their pregnancy or their own hopes. And sometimes they just don't understand.
I mean, you've written about the divisions between people who do and don't have children, and you've described them as kind of the have and have nots. Is this something that you felt more as you've got older?
Absolutely. I mean, people often, I think, make assumptions about why you don't have children. For me, because I write a lot about music, I think they possibly thought that I just like a sort of certain kind of lifestyle. And then there are just divisions you start to notice, probably sort of early 30s, and you start to notice when you are not invited to things because you don't have children.
Laura, when did you decide to try IVF?
I was in a relationship with someone for 4 years. I'd found out that my partner had cheated on me for the entirety of our relationship, including while I was pregnant. And I left him last summer with a view to doing solo IVF then. I'm an extremely independent person, so it didn't seem such a sort of huge stride, to be honest with you.
And had you done much research into it before you started? I mean, there's a lot of information out there, isn't there?
I hadn't done a lot of research. I simply turned up at my doctor's and was then put on the list to go to the local IVF unit. All the way along the line, I treated it as a need-to-know basis because I didn't want to start Googling things and send myself into a spiral.
Is it more difficult to go through IVF as a single person rather than as a couple?
Each health authority has different regulations about who is eligible for IVF. So even though I was referred by my GP, you know, and I waited the 3 months for my consultant appointment and then was told I wasn't eligible because I was single.
You weren't eligible because you were single?
Yeah, some health authorities will have cut-off points of 40, some will do 42, some will say yes to single women, some will say no. It's very frustrating thinking about women who decide to have a baby by themselves, because actually most of us who do have thought very long and hard about it. Plenty of couples have babies and don't really think about it.
I mean, it makes me so angry actually, because I think it is discriminatory. We know there are hundreds of thousands of single mothers doing a brilliant job bringing up children in this country. And, you know, the fact that you would have had to go to such great lengths to get your IVF treatment, I just think seems really wrong.
It's so wrong. It's so incredible, especially when the NICE guidelines say it should be all women, regardless of anything, up to the age of 42. It was a real shock and it made me very cross.
Something that fascinates me about this process is choosing your sperm donor. How on earth do you do that? And how much are you able to find out about them?
It was the funniest part and the most discombobulating part of this whole experience, because as soon as you start looking at sperm donor websites, it's just extraordinary. You can enter in as much or as little as you want to know. You can specify height and hair colour and hair texture and eye colour. You can search by zodiac sign, you can search by favourite pet, favourite food, profession, education. You can get baby photos, but you can also get adult photos. You can get a handwritten personal statement and voice notes. And there's one cryobank, I think it's maybe east coast of the US, and they give you like an outline of the donor's like head in profile. And it makes everybody look like a murderer for some reason. I mean, it's just the least attractive thing. But then it's so easy to get caught up in things like, oh, well, this person is a musician and this person is whatever. And then I drove myself slightly insane and thought, actually, what has been lacking from all my partners, I would say today, is kindness. Anyway, I got it down to two, and one was a wavy-haired musician and the type that I might date. I said to my friends, he sounds like the type of person I would date, and they all pointed out that that wasn't necessarily a good thing. And then the other one was a Bermudian engineering student. The staff at the cryobank had said how nice he was. So I got it down to the two of them, and one night, when I really had to choose, I lay in bed and I imagine their profiles being read in the voices of my ex-boyfriends. And in the end, I went with the Bermudian engineering student.
After this, Laura's IVF treatment in Crete begins. Back in Crete, can you tell me about the day of your first appointment at the clinic?
I walked to the clinic along the seafront, and it was this really bitter wind, and I remember thinking, oh God, I didn't bring my big winter coat, and what was I doing, and what am I doing here, and this whole thing was a mistake, and maybe I should go back home. It was really disorientating. And of course, because of COVID-19, they were measuring the temperature of everybody who went into the clinic, firing a temperature gun at your head, and you have to stand behind a line and whatever.
What was that treatment that you had on the first day? I mean, how does the IVF process work? What are the stages?
On that first day, they did lots of blood tests. I mean, similar to the tests that I had had already in the UK. And then your treatment is dependent on your results. So, you know, there are sort of pills and pessaries and injections, which are stimulating the ovaries to produce as many eggs as possible. You immediately feel really enormous and like your body isn't your own. And then they collect your eggs, and your eggs are taken away to the laboratory and fertilised, and they sit there for a while. In my case, they were allowed to grow into blastocysts. There are different stages in IVF. Sometimes people's eggs are transferred almost immediately after fertilisation, but mine sat in the lab for 5 days, and then they're put back into you. And as soon as you've had your eggs collected, you are fed another cocktail of drugs to make your pregnancy sustainable. I've never had trouble getting pregnant, I've had trouble staying pregnant, so that was a particularly crucial part of this. So it's so that you don't once they've sort of transferred the embryo, that you that it stays there is the idea.
It's incredible how they do it, really, isn't it?
Getting a call from the embryologist to give you an update on your blastocyst in a laboratory is kind of, it's magical, really.
You had a blood test and then you came back the next day to some good news. What happened?
They had been really, really positive, and my ultrasound scan had also been really hopeful. So they hoped for 15 or 16 eggs. And I went back and my midway point ultrasound, the stimulation hadn't been as successful as they'd hoped. They hoped then for 5 eggs. Yeah, that was a really sad day.
Did the doctors and nurses talk to you? Were you able to have many conversations with them?
The embryologist was so lovely. She said how much she was hoping it worked for me because she knew my circumstances. And that makes me cry even think about it now. And the embryologist actually came into the operating theatre when they did the transfer, and she played some Mozart via her phone, I think just to make me feel comforted.
And that embryo transfer, what was that like?
I imagine if you're with a partner and they're holding your hand, and it's probably a really, really intimate, special moment for some people. But for me, it was, you know, me and the consultant and a nurse and the embryologist listening to Mozart. It felt quite sterile. And, you know, I mentioned about how it was to be wandering around Heraklion in spring and looking at flowers, seeing couples hand in hand walking along the seafront, and that sort of real voluptuousness of the season. And instead, I was in this sort of grey building in a very sterile room wearing a hospital gown, and it has nothing to do with what you think of as reproduction or desire or any of that kind of stuff.
And while you were, you know, taking in this news and waiting for the sperm to arrive, how were you passing the time in Heraklion?
I was working, following the news, you know, like everybody in the world at that time. It was just refreshing news homepages, you know, looking at statistics and graphs.
After the embryos are transferred, Laura, your body goes through hormonal changes. Did you start to feel pregnant?
Yeah, I felt really pregnant for a week, and that was lovely. And then I woke up one morning and I suddenly didn't feel pregnant again. And you have to still keep on taking all the medication until you do a pregnancy test to sort of absolutely let you know whether or not you are. I wasn't surprised when it was negative, but I was very sad, obviously.
How did you process that?
It was a strange disconnection from my body at that point. When you do IVF, you look pregnant, your body starts to look pregnant. And there were times walking down by the sea where I thought, I bet people think I'm pregnant because I looked it in an early sense. But there's that horrible despair where you kind of just want to go home, and you don't at that point know how you're going to get home because, you know, I'd had all my flights cancelled. And I remember trying to put it in perspective. I think it was 717 people died that day in the UK of coronavirus. And I tried to, just give it some setting.
Laura, you wrote about going to Greece for IVF for The Guardian. Why did you decide to do that?
You will know when you do this kind of job, people always think you're going to write about a life experience. You know, people had said before I went, oh, you should write about it, or you should take a recorder and record notes and record your hospital appointments and all that kind of thing. And I really didn't want to. But I started writing things down because almost from the first day, I just thought this is important. And I don't even really know what I mean when I say that. I don't mean with some kind of great grandeur. It was important just for me to form a narrative that made sense. I didn't want to be the person who had IVF, you know. I didn't want to be some kind of representative of the IVF community or the fertility community or any of that kind of stuff. But I just wanted to write about loss in the time of a pandemic, really.
What sort of response have you had to it, and are there any that particularly resonated with you?
I've been a journalist for 20 years and I've written personal things before, and I've had huge responses to pieces I've written, but nothing like this. There is a really extraordinary thing about the people who message you in this immensely tender way, and so many people sharing their own stories, and you can't just like that. For days I felt overwhelmed by the kindness of people, but also by other people's stories, and feeling responsible for that a little bit, not in a bad way. But there's one in particular from a lady who said, who picked up on the paragraph where I talked about the embryo transfer and about being in the operating theatre with no one's hand to hold. And she said, well, you know, if you do this again, we're all holding your hand again. It's going to make me cry saying it. And that was just so lovely.
I mean, do you feel very glad that you've done that now? Do you feel that this has helped you?
I'm glad that I gave a lot of people who've written to me a little space to talk about their own losses. And you know, people haven't just written to me about IVF or fertility. They've written to me about deaths of parents, or just, as we discussed earlier, the fact that their life hadn't happened to them the way that they had expected.
Laura, do you plan to try IVF again?
Maybe. I'd probably do it over here if I were doing it again. It's expensive and you have to think, you know, an awful lot about that, obviously, particularly if you're single. But yeah, I think I'm still just figuring a lot of that out. I just was letting my body resettle and then we'll see.
What has this experience taught you about yourself or about how society views those who don't have children?
I think it has sort of reinforced that feeling that there is still so much conversation to be had about people not having children, particularly women not having children. I haven't wholly given up the hope yet, but you have to sort of recalibrate and find maybe hope or excitement in other ways. To move and to travel and to live elsewhere and to live differently, you have to embrace those, I think, and not just look at what you don't have.
Laura, thank you so much for speaking to me and for sharing your story.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your very kind and delicate questions, so thank you.
That was Laura Barton. Do read her article about travelling to Greece for IVF at theguardian.com. If you've been affected by anything we've talked about in this episode, you can find support at fertilitynetworkuk.org, which provides free and impartial advice for anyone affected by fertility issues, and tommies.org, which offers guidance and help for parents who lose a baby. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore and sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.